good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us a very special guest this evening, Kevin DeMeritt from Lear Financial. We're going to be talking about what's going on in the economic markets and the stock markets in the economy of the United States, because I think this is such a vitally important subject today. Kevin, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me back, Stan.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's going on since the last time we talked. Looks like, certainly to me, it looks like the automotive sales are not doing too well, that we're finding that foreign governments just aren't buying up the American debt. In fact, aren't we really pretty much dependent upon foreign countries to come in and buy up the debt of this country to keep going?
Well, we really are. They're buying up about $1.6 billion a day is what we need to try to keep this thing going. And we've accomplished that so far, but I think especially in the Asian region, we're starting to get a little bit of resistance from those people. We're starting to see that that's off a little bit from what they were purchasing a month ago. We're off by about $34 billion month over month.
And of course, it's a terrible situation for America to be in, to have to depend on other governments to provide the money to keep America solvent. We've never been in a situation like this before, have we?
Well, we really haven't. The debt is just absolutely enormous, and then we are in a period of raising interest rates, and just from what economists came out here today, for every quarter point that we raise interest rates, it's costing the government about $6.25 billion, and they're expected to raise rates over this next year about a point and a half or so. So I think there's more bad news to come, and I think that that's going to scare off more and more foreigners, which in turn we might have to continue to raise interest rates to draw that money in, which isn't going to be good news for a lot of the investments out there, especially in the real estate and the stock market.
Well, when you say that as we raise the interest rates, every quarter of a percent is about $6 billion, you're really talking about the money we have to pay then in interest on the national debt?
That's correct. That's correct. For every quarter point we raise our interest rates, that's what it's costing us as taxpayers, or having to borrow another $6.25 billion for every quarter point that we raise interest rates on our national debt.
So you know, we're up to maybe 1.25%. These are the short-term loans, the rate on short-term loans. We're really talking that if we went up over the next couple of years about 4% in interest rates, and some people think we're going to have to get that much higher to really begin to attract foreign investment, you're talking it's going to cost the government an extra $100 billion in interest, just interest on the national debt?
That's correct, and that's a scary thought, being the position that we're already in with this huge budget deficit, with spending over in Iraq, with these inflationary fears, so on and so forth. And you add in a situation where the real estate market has really been the stronghold for investors and consumers, and because of that increase in real estate values, or at least the stability of real estate values, people have been on a spending mode. You start raising interest rates, and you could have a big turnaround in the strongest investment that the economy has seen over the past year, year and a half.
But isn't a lot of this money that's been going into the home building business, isn't this really coming from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, these at least previously government subsidized corporations that are actually lending nothing down on a house? Used to be you have to put down 20%, and then they got it down to 10%, and sometimes now you can even get a house with nothing down, and then these ridiculously low adjustable rate mortgages, which are almost like a trap, because whenever you get an adjustable rate mortgage that's very low, one thing for sure, and that is when the interest rates go up, those adjustable rate mortgages are going to go up and up and up.
Well, that's right. I think the housing market right now is extremely scary. Matter of fact, there was a an ad, or not an ad, a story in the New York Sunday Times. Says housing bust, it won't be pretty, and it was a study by two economists at Goldman Sachs. They're saying right now that at current rates, home values are at least 10% overvalued, and if interest rates increase by one percentage point, most economists that they surveyed believe that home prices in the United States would be overvalued by approximately 15%. And usually, and further on in this story, they say that if the market did correct, you usually don't get just that 15% correction. You could get a 20-25% correction. Now, I don't know if that's going to happen in the United States here, but a 10 or 15% correction in the housing market would be very troublesome here in the United States. And one of the problems that we have, Stan, is despite these huge mortgage refinancing activity that we saw in 2001, 2002, 2003, and in at the beginning of 2004, consumers are more in debt than they were before all of this started. So they've increased their household debt. And this, what they've been doing is trading in their home equity for some extra pocket change, which helps this economy in the short term over these past 3 or 4 years. But long term, I think this big debt load is going to start weighing on their spending and therefore economic growth. And the government really doesn't have a whole lot of other options to drive the economy. Can we lower taxes anymore? Probably not. Can we lower interest rates anymore? Definitely not. So we're taking away a couple of the biggest tools the government has to spur on the economic growth.
And, you know, one of the things really that spurred on the economy were the increase in the value of property. And then, well, that was, you sort of created money out of nothing. A house that was worth, you know, $400,000 suddenly was worth $500,000. You could borrow an extra $100,000. You could sell. You could actually then spend that on a new car or a vacation or living it up or really whatever you wanted to spend it. But what happens if the value of that house goes down? Now, I think that the average individual has never seen property values fall and fall dramatically. But you remember when Japan had a problem about 10 years ago, a lot of the property over in Japan, overpriced, dropped as much as 80%. And you got a lot of banks over there holding, loans on property that was worth 20% of what they had loaned for it. And so the banks over in Japan got in real trouble, and they're still in real trouble.
Well, they have, and that real estate hasn't come back. Their real estate values have not come back. Their stock market was at 45,000, and here we are at around 12 or 14,000. That hasn't come back. And if in 1989 someone had told you that would happen, we would have got laughed out of the economic community.
No, I can remember when everybody was saying that the Japanese stock market was going to go to 100,000. It was 40,000, somewhere 45,000, because these are in yen. But I can remember my stockbroker telling me it's going to go to 100,000, you know, and the property values were going up. Everything was going up. But, of course, then came the day of reckoning, because there's no real value behind that in Japan. My concern is there's no real value behind so many of the values of the homes here in the United States.
That's correct. The aspect of this real estate market that's beginning to scare me more and more, and I don't want to be a doomsdayer, but you brought up the different types of loans that are out there and how much you had to put down. Well, you don't have to put anything down, and they'll give you an interest-only loan. We're down to the fact where you don't even need to pay principal. You just pay us the interest, and we'll go from there. And then there's the negative amortization loans where you're paying less interest. You owe it a little bit later, but you're paying even less interest, so you can get into those bigger homes and compete with the Joneses. That type of situation usually means the end is near. There's nothing more that they can do unless they're going to give the home away to get people in these larger homes and get people to upgrade.
But when you're having to borrow money from other countries just to keep the government running, eventually you're going to get to a point where this whole thing, in my estimation, is going to implode. We've seen it happen in Japan 10 years ago. We see it happen in Russia about the same time. We see it happen in Argentina about 2 or 3 years ago. A lot of people say, though, that it can't happen here.
Well, like I said, go back to Japan in 1989 when they were buying the Rockefeller Center. They were buying Pebble Beach. We thought that they were going to own Rhode Island or Hawaii, one or the other, to pay off our national debt. No one thought that it could happen then. If we would have pulled every economist out there, you might have found 2 out of 100 that said maybe there's some problems. But here we are, 14 years later, the world's second largest economy. Most people don't know that, but Japan is still this world's second largest economy. Is in has been in deep trouble, is depression, recession, whatever you want to call it. If your real estate values are down 70-80%, your stock market's down 75%, you've had some tough times. No one would have thought that would have happened in Japan. Why can't it happen in the United States? Now, I don't know to that extent if it would happen, but you get a 20-30% pullback in the stock market and a 15-20% pullback in real estate, and there's going to be some big problems in the United States, and those foreigners are not going to gobble up our bonds and take care of our debt like they have been.
Well, I think that this is different times than we've ever really had before, because before we always had certainly tariffs to protect our industries. We've taken down those tariffs. Other countries can have their tariffs to protect their economy, but we have left our economy bare, which is why so many of our major industries are moving offshore, the textile industry, the furniture industry, much of the steel industry, even a lot of the automotive and electronics. These are all leaving the United States, and what to me is most frightening, Kevin, is that we're losing manufacturing jobs. The statistics we see are put out by the government. Well, somebody once said, well, people are always making up statistics. Why shouldn't the government make up statistics? And it looks really great about all these new jobs, but they're not good manufacturing jobs. They're not good paying jobs. They're simply jobs. A lot of them are simply working for government or government agencies. But you can't have a vibrant economy unless you have manufacturing. And we are doing away with our manufacturing. We've never been in a situation like this before. We've never been in a major international war where we're building up the economy and providing health care and everything for the people over in Iraq. And yet, of course, you know, it seems that we've just taken on so much of as a nation. It's all costing money, and the money that we're giving now in foreign aid, we're borrowing from future generations. We don't have the money. The government is simply running up debt to continue spending, almost like a drunken sailor on a binge first night in town.
Well, that's right. If you look at Social Security and Medicare, you know, that the chickens are going to come home to roost sooner than I believe most people believe. But you brought up a great point. These statistics that the government's throwing around about how many jobs have been created, there was a statistic that I looked at that I think is very important for people to understand. The government can say that a lot of jobs have been created, but what kind of jobs? You know, personal income still remains under pressure because we have these higher value-added manufacturing jobs being exchanged for lower-paying part-time and service jobs. America is losing its manufacturing jobs, paying $45,000 or $60,000 a year, and it needs to supply three of these new service jobs, paying $15,000 or $20,000 a year, just to replace that one manufacturing job. And that's exactly what's happening. We haven't really seen the growth in income that we need to sustain this growth in the economy. Although the government is trying to tell us that these new jobs are being created at a pretty good clip, but what kind of jobs? You divide that by three, and then you get an idea of the income behind some of those jobs is really what we need.
And there's a wonderful article, and for any of our listeners, I would suggest Paul Craig Roberts, one of my favorite writers. You can go up on the internet and just punch in Paul Craig Roberts, and then they'll list his recent articles, and the one that deals with jobs, it's within the last month, where he really points out that we've lost, within the last couple of years, 3 million manufacturing jobs. Of course, we've probably lost a lot more than that in the preceding years, but there's just this really this tremendous sucking sounds as our manufacturing jobs are moving overseas. That's the term Ross Perot used, but I think it's very descriptive. Our industries are leaving. Our jobs are leaving. You can go to India. They're bustling. India, their economy is booming. Why? All the American jobs going over there, answering the telephones. Something happens to your Hewlett-Packard computer or printer, and you put in your call, and you talk to a guy named John. Well, his real name is Roz, and he's living in New Delhi, but he's going to tell you his name is John, and they do a good job over there. And, you know, they'll tell you what to do, and they're highly trained, highly skilled. They're going after excellence, and of course, so many of our schools here in America are giving mediocrity in education a new meaning. Our kids know far more about sex than they do about Shakespeare, far more about Marilyn Monroe than they know about mathematics. India is trying to get the best education in the world for their students, and here in America, we're simply not emphasizing learning, we're emphasizing feelings, and environmentalism, and of course we learn how to hug trees and how to all about the global warming, but we don't learn anything about global economics or the sophisticated computer technology. That's all being taken care of by our competitors throughout the world. I don't think that we can survive as a first-rate nation with an educational system such as we have. What are your thoughts on that, Kevin?
Well, I don't think we can survive with the educational system, and we need to increase that for sure, and that's what a lot of the politicians talk about, but I don't see really too much getting done on a state level or on a federal level. Number two, we can't survive as a first-rate nation with the kind of debt that we have out there, and you're right, we're taking that debt and we're laying it on future generations here, and if those future generations do not have the education to manage that debt and do something about it, and we don't start here soon with the people that are educated about it and understand it, then we're going to be in a world of hurt in the next 10 or 15 years when Social Security and Medicare and some of the other programs out there start to become reality of there's just not enough money. What do? Push out the year to 75 or 79 before people can retire and start getting Social Security, or do we increase that Social Security to 10 or 15% of your paycheck? Those are some tough choices, and we have such a huge baby boomer population that's going to be in control of making those rules and regulations pretty soon, that it just starts becoming a very scary situation. So I think you're right. We need to educate people now, not only for future generations, but the people that are listening to this program and not listening to this program, to try to get them on the right path and elect the people that are going to start taking care of this debt and some of the things that are wrong here in the United States, education being one of them.
Well, I'll never forget when I ran for Congress back in 1988, and I was told, went back to Washington, D.C., to a school for political candidates, and they said the one thing is not to talk about Social Security and never mention Social Security's bankrupt. Of course, it was bankrupt in 88, and here we are, of course, 16 years later. Things are even worse. The unfunded mandates for Social Security and Medicare are $44 trillion. The figure doesn't mean people can't imagine what $1 trillion would be, and $44 trillion, yet that is what we owe on Social Security, and there's no money there. There's just no way in the world we're going to meet all of the requirements, all the promises that the politicians have made to buy the votes of the people, to keep the politicians in office so they can live well and retire with a good income and maybe even get a job as a lobbyist at $50,000 a month, lobbying the members of Congress to spend more money, and so that's what lobbyists do. $50,000 a month they were paid to lobby to get this drug bill through that's going to cost us $500 billion over 10 years, money we just don't have. So what should people be doing? How should they begin approaching this? Because if people don't take responsibility for themselves, I fear that many of the people in America are going to lose everything they have.
Well, I think there's a couple of things to do. Number one, again, educate yourself about what's happening out there. And number two, protect yourself from the things that are happening out there with your investing, with the way that you look at your money, maybe a little bit differently, the way you save, maybe increase your savings rate, get into the types of investments that are going to take advantage of these higher interest rates that are coming, maybe higher inflation rates that may be coming. Some of the bubbles that we see out there in the real estate market, even when you start raising interest rates, you possibly some things that are happening in the stock market. One of the areas that we feel is a great opportunity because of what's happening out there is the precious metals market. We have some information for people to educate themselves about precious metals. And maybe we could give that away once we get through this break.
Why don't you just go ahead? We've got about 50 seconds. Why don't you just tell if you have a telephone number or something or website you'd like to get out? Go ahead.
You bet. We have a free gold investor's guide and an audio tape entitled Interest Rates and the Gold Boom Ahead. It's normally $29. If they mention that they heard it on your program, we're going to give away everything free of charge. All they need to do is call us at 888-302-7111. That's 888-302-7111.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment. Our special guest this evening is Kevin DeMeritt of Lear Financial, and we invite your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Kevin DeMeritt. We're talking about really what's going on in the financial markets, and of course the question is always raised, are we going to have deflation? Are we going to have inflation? Now, my understanding is, and I've heard this, and I'd like your thoughts on this, Kevin, that a lot of the money market managers out there, the people who have a lot of money, other people's money, that a lot of them really aren't quite sure how to invest. And we've heard that Warren Buffett is sitting on something like $40 billion. Of course, he doesn't have it in American bank because he doesn't trust the stability of our currency. He's worried about the derivative market, which he refers to as financial weapons of mass destruction, currently latent but potentially lethal. And he believes that if this whole thing begins to implode, why, of course, it's going to bring down a lot of the institutions here in the United States. So my understanding is that Warren Buffett is heavily invested, but not in the United States. He's waiting for something to happen. He thinks there's going to be a lot of good bargains out there, and he's sitting in a tremendous amount of cash. Have you heard things of this sort?
Yeah, we've heard that he's sitting on enormous amounts of cash and also in foreign currencies, which he's just started purchasing for the first time in his career a few years ago, which turned out to be a phenomenal move, but who's surprised by what Warren Buffett does with his investments? It's incredible. But he purchased silver when it was $3.25 an ounce, 20% of the above-ground silver supply, not of the United States, but of the world, and has done extremely well with that investment also. Now, it's a little bit secretive to how much he's still holding. No one really knows. We just know that he did purchase 20% above-ground silver supply and has some large positions in the metals market. When you look at other people like John Hathaway of the Tocqueville Fund, he says, bottom line, he thinks gold can go to $1,000 an ounce. The Wall Street Journal recently says, if history is any indicator, gold is set to rally in a big way. So these people are thinking outside of the box, outside of traditional investments, and if we get the deflation or inflation, deflation like we saw in the Great Depression or inflation like we saw through the 70s, the precious metals market has been a place for people to invest and benefit from either rising interest rates because of inflation or deflation because interest rates and driving interest rates down to zero. So I think we're in a great situation right now. No matter what the economy does, at least precious metals are going to be a decent part of someone's portfolio. Not that they should put 100% in precious metals. A good 10 or 15% right now would be a good percentage to have in the portfolio to give yourself some diversification.
Well, now, how do you feel? Should people be in gold? Should they be in silver? Should they be in coins? Should they be in bullion? Should they be in the currency? Pardon me, in those silver coin bags of silver coins. Where should they be putting their money?
You know, that's a great question. I get asked all the time. Now that we're recommending the precious metals so heavily right now, and it really depends on the individual. There's good short-term positions that could be handled. There's good great long-term positions. It depends on age. If you're looking for income, obviously the gold and silver and precious metals market is not something that you want to put a big percentage in. Maybe you'd only want 4 or 5%. If you're looking for income, you need to have most of your money out there working for you. Depends on age and so on and so forth. So what we do is sit down, Stan, with each individual who calls and would like to have a little bit more education in this area and really try to find out exactly what their goals are, how old they are. Are they looking for children's education? Are they looking for retirement? Are they looking just for a diversification hedge? And try to sit down and come up with the best strategy for each one of those people. But I think the precious metals market in gold right now is a little bit better than the silver market simply because of the
floor. Hold that thought for just a moment. We got to bring our students.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Kevin DeMeritt. We're talking about where people should be investing. And he was saying that he thinks that gold is a better investment right now than silver. You want to pick up the story there? And why do you prefer gold over silver at the present time? And in what form should it be?
Well, I like the gold market more than the silver market because we've seen a little bit of a pullback from $430 an ounce down to about $390. Which is an area that I think is a good investment floor, somewhere in the neighborhood of 383 to 390 is a good place to get involved in the gold market again. We were trying to keep people away from it at 430 and wait for this pullback, and it happened. I think with the increase in interest rates, with what's happening over in Iraq and so on and so forth, the gold market just has more international liquidity value to it and so on and so forth. So I think that that's just a better place for investors to be. You get the liquidity. It has some good upside potential. We're seeing a forecast come out from Merrill Lynch somewhere in the neighborhood of $450 to $550 an ounce. So if we took the low number, you can still pick up around 12 or 15% on your money. And then we have forecasts with gold as high as $1,000 or $1,250 an ounce. So I don't. Those might be far-reaching in the near term, but at least those forecasts are out there. And about the best forecast I can find in the silver market right now is about $8, $9 an ounce from most reasonable economists out there. So I think there's just more better upside potential, more liquidity, and less downside risk with the gold market as opposed to the silver market.
Well, of course, these have always been very narrowly traded markets. But tell me, what is happening as far as the other countries are concerned? Because this is a whole different world. We're in a totally different market than we've ever seen before. I mean, you've got 1.25 billion people in China, and of course, a growing number of these have disposable income. The same thing is happening over in India, where you have a billion people. I mean, ideas, numbers of people that are suddenly entering the market, and some of these people are buying precious metals. We have any idea how much of the precious metals they're picking up? Because there's only a certain amount of gold out of the ground anywhere in the world today. After the Second World War, it was about 35 billion. I don't know how much gold there is together altogether. But, you know, the same thing is certainly true of silver. What is happening as far as the gold and silver markets in the Orient, in India, in China? What's happening as far as the gold and silver market in the Muslim countries that have about 1.25 billion people? And then, of course, what's happening in Europe? Do you have any idea?
Well, yes. In the Middle Eastern countries, they have the new gold dinar, well, new as of 2-3 years ago. I don't know how much activity that currency is getting, but it's going to add more demand to gold than it's going to take away from demand, so that's a new demand. Right now, annual production for gold is between 2,500 and 2,800 tons. Annual demand, so we have the production of 2,500 to 2,800 tons, and the annual demand averaging right now at about 4,200 tons over the past 10 years. So the short position, the difference between what's being produced and what's being demand on the demand side is open to debate, but it sits somewhere between 1,500 and 2,500 tons, which is 1 or 1.5 years worth of supply, depending on which year you're talking about over this past 10 years. One of the incredible opportunities in the gold market, Stan, that we're seeing, and you've brought up, is in the Asian countries. China has just legalized gold ownership for its citizens for the first time in 47 years. Now, some experts think this is going to create about a 3,000 tons of new demand. If we cut that number in half and it's 1,500 tons, we're looking at about half of 1 year's production being eaten up by just that country allowing its citizens for the first time in 47 years to purchase gold. Now, if we bring that full circle, here in the United States, it was illegal to own gold between 1933 and 1974. In 1974, when they opened up or legalized gold ownership, it opened up the floodgates to a heck of a lot of people here in the United States, about 200 million people, to be able to physically own gold. Gold went from $35 an ounce to $850 an ounce. Now, we had inflation, we had higher oil prices, and so on and so forth, but we've got some of that happening now. This is opening up the floodgates to 1.2 billion people in China alone that haven't been able to physically own gold at a reasonable price, had to purchase it in jewelry. That's going to have some dramatic effect on the price of gold in the next 9 to 12 months.
Probably on the price of everything. It was Napoleon once said, let China sleep, for when China awakens, the earth will
don't
tremble.
Don't wake them up.
The earth will tremble. And this is going to have an impact. And, of course, the same thing is happening in India. Today, these are extremely intelligent people. They don't believe the propaganda put out by the controlled media in America that gold is a relic of bygone days. They want something of intrinsic value, rather than a piece of paper with some green ink printed on it that is losing value very, very rapidly. We'll be back here in just a moment or two, and welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Kevin DeMeritt of Lear Financial, and we're talking about what's going on in the gold and silver markets, what's going on in the world economy. And our telephone number is, of course, once again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. I think it's important that people understand that we are living, I believe, in very, very perilous times. I believe that there is a small group of people who are manipulating the stock market. We saw this back in the 1929s. It was illegal, but J.P. Morgan lost $5 billion. Now, remember, $5 billion was a lot of money in those days, because it was probably worth about 10 times what would be today. We're talking he lost literally a fortune trying to prop up the stock market, and it couldn't be propped up. But today, every time the market starts to fall, orders start coming in from one or two brokerage houses, bidding up the stocks to keep them from collapsing, because it's all perception. It is how you look at things. And you look at that Dow Jones average, and if it's going up, you feel good. If it's going down, you feel bad, without understanding that they're playing games with our minds. And I, in my own mind, am firmly convinced that there are people out there working in conjunction with the Federal Reserve Board, which incidentally is a privately owned central bank. It is a bankers. It's owned by bankers and people of great wealth who can create money out of nothing. It's the greatest scam of all time. You simply, if you have $100,000 in deposit, you can then loan up to $1 million. That's pretty good. You can loan money you don't have. You create it out of nothing, and then you charge interest on it. Believe me, it's the greatest scam of all time. But our whole economy is built upon debt. We have a totally fiat money system, and in my estimation, there's never been a fiat money system that has survived. So, where are we going from here?
Well, I think we've got a couple of situations. We're going to get what Alan Greenspan was ultimately afraid of, which was deflation. If the real estate market pops, I think it's going to bring down a lot of the other markets. So we cannot raise interest rates too fast, which leaves us to the only other alternative, which debt can be handled in a couple of ways. Number one, earn enough money to pay it off, which means to the government raising taxes. I don't think that's going to happen, or enough to pay off this debt. Number two, we default. That's probably not going to happen. We borrow even more. That's already happening. Or you pray for inflation, so you can earn more dollars but really pay back less, which I think is the best alternative that the Greenspan and the government has for us. So I think they continue to pump up the money supply as much as they possibly can.
Hold that thought, Kevin. We've got to bring our stations back on.
Sure.
Well, Dr. Stan, and if Ed calls back, why, we'll be glad to put him on. We just wanted to get through that break. But our guest this evening is Kevin DeMeritt. And Kevin is certainly supports Radio Liberty, helps us stay on the air. And he was just saying that he thinks that the government has several options. One of them, of course, is to borrow more money or to print more money. Or one of the things that they can do is simply devalue the dollar. In other words, make it worth less so they can pay the number of dollars that they owe. But unfortunately, they'll have little or no value. And so this is certainly what's always happened down through the centuries when the governments got into a situation such as we are in today. They owe more. There's no way they possibly can meet all their obligations. And rather than admit that, why, of course, the people out there all across America who have pension obligations coming from the major corporations, there's no way there's enough money in those pensions to pay the pensioners. So what you do is you destroy the value of the money, and then you give them the money that is owed them, but it's not worth much of anything. Do you think that's what's really going to happen?
Well, I believe that it is. We haven't seen inflation subside, and when you see it start to move down into the 1% range, the Fed gets very nervous and starts pumping up the money supply. They would rather have inflation. It's the better of two evils. If you had deflation or inflation, you could either go into a depression like we saw in 1933. It was a lot worse than what we saw in the 70s with inflation. So the government would rather give us inflation rather than the deflation, and I think that that's not going to stop. It's going to continue, and it's probably going to get worse, because if you start raising interest rates a little too much, and what's a little too much? No one really knows. It's that one next ratchet up that drops the real estate values or drops the stock market like we saw in 2000. That puts us right back into a recession, and then they start pumping up the money supply again to try to get the economy back up on its on two legs here. That's what's happening. But I'm not sure that they're doing such a great job here. Last year we saw personal income increase 2%, individual debt increased 10%. So if we added up what people owed on personal debt for autos and credit cards, etc., that topped about $2 trillion, up about $120 billion. Despite all of this massive debt consolidation and mortgage refinancing, mortgage debt rose about $800 billion, and total individual debt rose $925 billion. Wages and salaries, Stan, only rose $190 billion. So I'm not quite sure that they're doing what they're telling us that they've done, which is no big surprise, but really accomplishing getting people's debt down and getting this economy primed. I think it's on a tightrope, and depending on how high interest rates go is going to depend how long this economy can run.
But they're really going to have to raise interest rates because we have inflation. You mentioned that the salaries were up about 2% last year, but what people don't understand is what inflation is. Now, the government will admit it's 4%, but of course they're simply lying because the way they calculate this, it was the old adage, figures don't lie, but liars figure. Well, they say, well, we'll take the food out because we don't want to put that in inflation index because it's going up. And we'll take energy out and gasoline out, and we'll take out this and that and the other thing, and we'll leave in underwear that's coming in from China, and we'll leave in factory goods that are coming in from China. And see, there's only 4% inflation. Whereas, of course, the truth of the matter is it's probably 7%. In fact, Bob Chapman, who we interview regularly, the international forecaster, says that Alan Greenspan has privately told people the inflation rate is 7%. Chapman feels it's closer to 9%. So if you get a 2% raise in inflation, of course, takes care of that 2%, and you lose, let's imagine Greenspan is right, you're only going behind 5%. If that continues year after year, it doesn't take very long before why the middle-class America is pretty well impoverished, because inflation will wipe out a nation quicker than anything else. I remember back in 1970 when we had inflation, maybe it was 71, when Richard Nixon imposed wage and price controls because the inflation rate was 5%. Now, they readily admit it's 4%, probably 7%, and of course we just shrug and say, oh, well, there's nothing to worry about. I think there's a lot to worry about. I think inflation will destroy this nation, and the savings and everything that people have in their annuities and their bank accounts and their CDs and their pensions and everything that people have put their confidence in, the value of their bonds, because bonds are destroyed by inflation.
That's right. Well, there's not been many times in history that we've seen the government hold, or the Federal Reserve hold, interest rates below the stated inflation rate, we'll call it, but it is right now. If they admit it's 4%, and we have interest rates that the Fed just increased, let's call it 1.5%, we've got a discrepancy there that needs to be taken care of, and it will. At some point, they're going to raise interest rates to at least what the inflation rate is. Basically, they're giving money away, and it's costing them money to do it, which will cause inflation. So we will get some inflation. Alan Greenspan will raise interest rates. I wouldn't be surprised if he raised them again here fairly soon, and then another one or two right after the election. But what's been really keeping this economy going has not just been him keeping these interest rates low. It's been this mortgage refinancing that's been going on, and these people have been spending like crazy. When that stops, how fast is the economy really going to continue at 3 or 4% growth? If we start getting back down to 1.5% or 2% growth, it feels like a recession again. And then they continue to hold down the interest rates, and you pump up the money supply some more, and we try to make another run at it. Hopefully the real estate values don't fall off, but something's got to give here. There's too much weight on the bridge, and it's got to crack somewhere.
Well, we've got Ed calling from Aptos. Ed, did you have a question for our guest?
Question. If he was betting your guest, what would he say gold and silver would be going up to in like two, 3 months?
In 2, 3 months?
Yeah, from now.
That's tough because the election's right around the corner. You start getting something after the election, but I'll give you a 9 to 12 month forecast. I think the precious metals market with gold could be somewhere in the neighborhood of 435 to 485. That's what the gold market could trade at. In the silver market, we're looking at somewhere around $7.25 to maybe $8.50. Those are some estimates that we've forecasted over the next 9 to 12 months.
All right, fine. And so if you're out in the listening audience, you have a question, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest is Kevin DeMeritt from Lear Financial. And these are issues that people have to begin to realize that we are on the edge of dramatic financial changes. Now, everybody says everything's going to be fine. I think that Kevin's absolutely right. They're keeping the ship stable, at least through the elections. After all, if there was a crisis of some sort, why, this could shift the people's votes. The old adage that Bill Clinton had, he had a big sign in his office there during the presidential campaign in 1992, and that was, it's the economy, stupid. It's the economy, stupid. Well, I think there are a lot of people will vote if the economy is good. They'll vote for the current administration. Doesn't matter how corrupt and evil and they are. They'd vote for Bill Clinton, who lies and lies and lies as long as their wallets are full. But believe me, when the wallets are empty, when people are looking for jobs, why, of course, they're going to not vote for the opposition, hoping something will change and things will get better. The thing is, so everything is being done, and I believe Alan Greenspan, although he's not supposed to, I believe Alan Greenspan is pandering to the president, trying to keep the economy going through the end of this year, certainly not doing what he should have done a long time ago, and that was raise interest rates to try to slow down inflation, to liquidate the debt, let people lose their jobs, let them lose their homes, but try to get rid of the debt so you'll have a solid base upon our economy to grow. But he's not done any of these things. He's played the political game, and that, of course, is the reality where we are. Let's go to Tony, who's calling from Soquel, and he has a question. Hi, Tony. How are you doing? Oh, I guess, Tony, are you there?
Yes, hi.
Hi. Hi. Haven't heard from you in some time.
Oh, I'm around, though.
Oh, okay, fine.
I usually listen to the programs on the Internet after they're a couple of days old.
Okay, fine. Well, do they improve, like a steak? Do they get better if they age a little better?
Well, you can replay them if you want.
Okay, fine.
Well, my question is concerning interest rates. If interest rates do climb, and I think it's kind of a foregone conclusion, part A here is, wouldn't that make the dollar go up? As it has in the past, usually higher interest rates, that means the dollar goes up, and if the dollar goes up, doesn't that usually a negative for gold and silver?
All right, good question. How would you respond to Tony, Kevin?
Well, that's a fantastic question, and it sounds like he's been listening to a lot of the media that have been talking about gold, but the greatest rise in interest rates that I can remember happened to be the highest that gold had ever traded at, that I could remember, $850 an ounce, and the interest rates were about 15%. What we've typically found is when interest rates start to rise, it's because of something. It's because of inflation. It's because of a deficit. It's because of some negative effect, and they're trying to support that dollar. It usually doesn't happen in the beginning, and it drives the precious metals market much, much higher like we saw through the 70s. So if you look at a 40-year chart of interest rates, usually there's 20 years on average of rising rates and then 20 years of falling rates. Precious metals has not performed well when interest rates have been falling and performed extremely well when interest rates are rising. You can see that through the 70s when interest rates are rising, and then the last 20 years as they were falling. It's been horrible for the gold market.
And basically, I remember when Paul Volcker, and this was in 1980, jacked that interest rates up, whether it was 17 or 19%, something like that. And that's when gold was going through the roof, because there was monetary uncertainty, and the question was, were they going to be able to stop inflation, or was the dollar going to collapse? And that, I think, is what in large part what drove the price of precious metals at that time, silver to $50, gold to $850, and platinum almost to $1,000.
That's right.
Okay, anything else, Tony?
I thought that was a pretty good answer, because I was kind of giving the standard media line. I have been a long-term metals investor for quite some time, and I never got in with the thought that it wasn't going to be a a long hold. So one of the things that particularly interests me is what has been happening in the silver market, for example, with the creation of paper silver, and the there's 4 to 8 very large short sellers who create paper silver out of it's just paper, and then they short it.
Could you
and they manipulate the market?
Could you explain what paper silver is? I don't think that most of our listeners would understand. They're selling what they don't have. Is that right?
Are you asking me?
Yes. Uh huh.
Well, yes. They just it's like an IOU. They say that they can deliver silver, and they create something like 500-600 million ounces out of nothing, and they're allowed to sell it as a real commodity short, and they continue to keep the prices down through this manipulation.
Well, they do, but if people take delivery of their silver, then these people are in real trouble, because he who sells what isn't his and has to give it back or go to prison.
Well, the actual amount of available silver in the COMEX warehouses, like there was a big transfer about 2 weeks ago, almost 20 million ounces. The eligible category now, I believe it's down to about 45, 46 million ounces. And there's something like 500 million ounces, which is something like 10 times that, just on the futures that's being shorted, which doesn't exist. But
did you have a question for Mr. Demerit?
Well, when do you think that the if you keep up on the this massive manipulation, I don't know if you have or not, but when do you think the writing will be on the wall that it's about to come to an end?
Well, I think we get into 2005.
I'm not listening to you on the air. Thank you.
Sure. I think as we get into 2005 and Alan Greenspan has more availability to do what he wants to do and start raising interest rates without affecting this election, you're going to see more and more effect on the precious metals market in a positive way. I don't believe the dollar is going to get stronger, not with the type of deficit that we have, not with the type of real estate bubble that I believe we have, not with this global uncertainty and terrorism, and the spending in Iraq, not with all of this consumer debt. The countries that are out there that support our dollar are really moving away and looking for an alternative. Precious metals, I think, is going to be one of them. For China, it is. India and some of the other countries out there in the Middle East with the gold dinar. You're going to, and Warren Buffett here in the United States, first time in his career he buys foreign currency. People are looking for alternatives to the U.S. dollar, and I don't think higher interest rates are going to drive people to the U.S. dollar like the media is saying. So I think precious metals really start to shine after this election. I think we could get a bump up into the 4.25 to 4.30 range right before the election as the smart money starts to move back into this market. We're already starting to see some of that start to happen in the metals market. Like I say, I think gold is better than the silver market for the manipulation you're talking about because of the volatility that we've seen. But 3.83 to 3.90 in the gold market, you start to see a lot of the big money coming back in and giving it a real strong floor.
All right. And should people be buying bullion coins? Or should they be buying collector's coins if they're not sophisticated in this market? What should people be buying? Should they be buying simply bars of gold, or should they be buying gold stocks? Where should they be investing?
Well, I liked the gold stocks about 3 years ago simply for the fact that if you look at the valuation of gold mining companies right now, gold would have to still get up to somewhere in the neighborhood of about $485 an ounce to justify the levels that most mining companies are trading at right now. So I tend to stay away from the mining companies right now and work with the physical metal. As far as the type of physical metal that people should have in their portfolios, yeah, some of the collectible coins have done extremely well, especially if you work in those collectible type coins, and we have availability for people to invest in that area, only work with PCGS or NGC graded coins so you have the liquidity, you don't have to be an expert, and the coin is already graded in a hard plastic holder for you so that you can buy and sell it. But it's just like investing in any other types of real estate or stocks. You still need diversification. So if you have a larger position that you're looking to place into the precious metals market, collector coins have a place in that. So does the precious metal. So diversification is the rule, even when you're talking about precious metals. Could be silver, gold, some palladium market looks fantastic right now. It was $1,100 an ounce. You can pick it up for about $240 an ounce right now. And it's got a lot of applications that are starting to come back in. So there's some great opportunities in the metals market. But again, it's kind of hard to pinpoint and say this is the exact thing people should own unless I sit down and look at their financial positions, how old they are, if they need income, so on and so forth.
All right, fine. We've got Joan calling from Chicago. Joan, are you there?
Hello.
Hi, did you have a question or comment?
No, I have a question.
All right, fine.
Can you answer a question on real estate?
All right, well, let's, why don't you ask Mr. Demerit? He may be a lot smarter than I am. What was the question?
Okay, here's what I want to know is, if you own a condominium and we should go into a recession or a depression, how secure is your finances there when many people, let's suppose in the building, might be losing their condo? Let's suppose they had mortgage. Even if you had paid for yours, you might be in a multiple building. I just wonder, how secure is it owning property in a condo?
All right. Do you have any thoughts on that, Kevin?
Well, I like the condo market. Again, 3-4 years ago, I think you bring up a great point about condominiums that maybe a lot of people haven't thought about. You get into a condominium complex, especially a smaller complex with 15 or 20 units or something like this, and those homeowners associations that you pay, all of a sudden you have 20 or 30% of your condominiums vacant. Your homeowners is not covering to try to keep that property up and keep it in tip-top shape so that the new buyers coming in continue to pay less and less because it looks more and more run down. So right now in this type of economy, I would try to pay down as much debt as I possibly could if I owned a condominium, or get out at today's levels and go look for maybe a small home that you're in more control of.
You know, that was my thought, but I just wanted to hear what you thought about that.
Now, the condominium market is a great way for maybe a first-time homeowner, and if you purchased it 2-3 years ago and were looking to flip it, it was a great opportunity to do something like that. Condominiums in some areas are costing more than a home.
Right.
But in today's environment, especially in rising interest rates, so on and so forth, with that homeowner's fee, that's what really kills you, because if there isn't enough people to pay that and keep the property up to snuff, you know, the place looks run down and there's nothing you can do about it. They try to raise the homeowner's fees, which is taking more money out of your pocket, and then the values start to fall.
Okay, anything else?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, I just want to, then, of course, the major question, is what about the availability of money? What is the Fed doing as far as the availability of money concerned? Usually when they're pouring money into the economy through the various means that they have, M2 and M3, the economy looks good, and then they begin contracting that M3 and these various monetary increments. Then we begin to feel this in the economy. What's really happening? Are you keeping an eye on that?
Well, we are. He's trying to wring out some of the excess, but you raise interest rates 0.25 point in this type of environment, you might as well not have done anything.
Right.
A half a point to a point would have been something that would have been substantial, but 0.25 point is really nothing. And the stock market took it on the chin right after we had this increase. So, God only knows what's going to happen when he does it. Another 0.25 point or a half a point here in the next 6 or 9 months, what's going to happen in those types of markets? What's going to happen to the real estate market? What's going to happen to the stock market?
Well, of course,
that's why I think you need some alternatives right now.
Right. I think the real estate market will begin to collapse, I think, when they begin to tighten down on money. Have they started yet?
Well, they have. They've started a little bit. I think the banks are starting to get a little bit more nervous. They're looking for more quality type of people, but they have a quandary. Banks are there to lend money. These new no interest rate or just interest rate loan, no principal type loans, they have to compete, and they have to try to do what Enron and all these other banks or these corporations have done, and boost up their earnings to try to keep the stock price high. And it's going to be very, very difficult when those banks are trying to compete against one another, and you've got a lender there that you don't want to lend money to, but if you don't, you know he's going to walk down the street and go get the money from someplace else, so they go ahead and lend to him anyway. Which is exactly what happened in Japan, and then the whole thing fell apart, and they have a huge banking problem. That could definitely happen here in the United States. I don't think it could happen to the extent that it happened over there, because they had some pretty weird banking rules and regulations that we don't have, but we could get a real sock on the chin here.
Okay, well, we're out of time, Kevin. Would you like to give your telephone number once again if people would like to get that report you're offering?
Sure. If they give us a phone call at 888-302-7111, they get our free Gold Investor's Guide and the audio tape, Interest Rates and the Gold Boom Ahead. And by the way, this Interest Rates and the Gold Boom Ahead also includes real estate and a lot of other investments in this audio tape that's normally $29. We're going to give all of that away free. All they have to do is give us a call. Again, the number is 888-302-7111.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so very much. Really appreciate you being with us, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
You bet.
Good night. Okay, fine. Well, that was Kevin DeMeritt of Lear Financial. And then, of course, I need to mention to our listeners in Chicago, apparently the station has been sold. We will not be with you after the end of this month. However, you can hear us on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com. In fact, you can listen to us 5 hours a day at www.radioliberty.com, or you can listen to us on shortwave, and Radio Liberty does offer shortwave sets. So they're going to be changing our frequency. My understanding right now, this evening program is being heard at 7.535 megahertz. Supposedly, a week from now, it'll be at 7.315. That's 7.315 megahertz. So we'd certainly appreciate hearing from you. How your reception is going to be on the new frequency, but a week from now, 7.315 megahertz, and of course, if you're in Chicago, why, we hate to go off the air there, but apparently this station has been sold. Again, the telephone number, if you'd like to, pardon me, the Internet site, if you'd like to listen to us on the Internet, RadioLiberty.com. And hope that many of our listeners will get onto the computer and get other people onto the computer, because we're trying to bring in the information that you're not going to hear elsewhere. We're in real trouble financially. We have a monetary system that's built upon sand. It's a fiat money system. If you have not read the book, Fiat Money, Inflation in France, it was written over 100 years ago by the president of Yale University, Andrew Dickinson White, about what happened in France in 1790. You need to understand the history of the past to understand what's going on today. If you read Andrew Dickinson White's book, it's almost like deja vu all over again. You can get the book by itself, Fiat Money, Inflation in France, or along with a book called Bastiat's The Law, or The Law by Bastiat. Bastiat was a contemporary of Karl Marx. This book was written in 1848. What's wrong with socialism? And, of course, what's really wrong with socialism, it is a return to a feudalistic society, which is exactly what is happening in America, where everything is going to be done to destroy the middle class. If you destroy the value of their currency, you destroy the value of their savings, you destroy the middle class. And this is what happened in Argentina just a couple of years ago when the government was acting irresponsibly. And I fear that the same thing is going to happen here in the United States. We're borrowing today not from our children, but from our great-great-grandchildren, and unfortunately, they're not going to have to pay this off. We're going to pay it off for the destruction of our currency. So begin trying to understand what's going on. Help us, you know, reach people across America. Get them listening to our Internet, our shortwave programs, the very stations you're listening to. And then, of course, we'll be back again tomorrow evening. Until then, this is Dr. Stan saying goodbye, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we always welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But hold your calls for a few minutes. We hope to have with us very, very shortly Karen Malik, and we're going to be talking about the ABC connection. That's the abortion breast cancer connection, and there is an organized effort to conceal the truth from the American people. But you must understand that there is an organized effort to conceal the truth about so many issues from the American people. I was just reading this evening about how many of our states now have actually passed new legislation to help the tobacco companies because they lost all these lawsuits and they're appealing the lawsuits. And over 30 states have passed legislation to help the poor old struggling tobacco companies, which have a program designed to kill off large numbers of the American people. Smoking is deadly. I mean, it produces not only cancer of the lung, but cancer of the bladder and cancer of the pancreas and all sorts of cancers. And of course, it destroys the cardiovascular system. It destroys, the lungs. It produces asthma and emphysema, and the tobacco companies knew that, and they knew it was addicting. They lied before Congress. How many of the people who lied under sworn testimony, how many of them ever been indicted and sent to prison? Not one single one. Why? Because the government has been encouraging this. Why? Because there are too many people in the world, too many people in this country, and it's far better off to kill them off so we don't have to provide pensions for them and medical care and all of those things when they grow old. Now you say, well, that's a terrible thing to say. Nobody could be that ill, that evil, and I would like to suggest that they really can be. We have evil people. We have people like Jacques Cousteau, that great man, that great humanitarian and environmentalist, who said, we're going to have to eliminate 350,000 people a day. If you find that hard to believe, we have the article out of the UNESCO Courier back in November of 1991. We'll be glad to send you a free copy of the pages involved. That's UNESCO Courier, November of 1991, Jacques Cousteau, advocating eliminating 350,000 people a day. And so we're suppressing treatments for cancer. We're facilitating the production of cancer. We're fluoridating the water, which is carcinogenic. We're putting aspartame and NutraSweet in our various food products and our diet cola because it produces brain cancer. And the government knows all of these things. But they're not here to help us. They are here to help us to an early demise. And one of the big cover-ups of all time is the abortion breast cancer connection, and with us is Karen Malik. Hi, Karen. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm fine, thanks.
Well, of course, you are on the front lines of this battle, and I know that you've dedicated yourself to trying to get the story out, and there's been all sorts of cover-ups. In fact, there was a recent report where they said, well, now we've finally put this whole issue to rest. There's no connection at all. Why don't you tell us what's going on and how they're deceiving the American people, and so many of these young women who are having their abortions today are going to end up dying of the disease that was promoted by that abortion. And we're saying we're trying to, you know, make women's lives happier, but if they're going to end up and they have a significant increased chance of getting a breast carcinoma, and if you have two or three abortions without ever having a pregnancy, your chances goes up double or even triple of breast carcinoma. But they're suppressing this information from the American people, because, of course, there are people out there who are unconcerned about the terrible suffering that we're bringing about. Tell the story, Karen.
Oh, I'd love to tell you the story. This research goes back to 1957, and women have not been told about the existence of the research. We now have 29 epidemiological studies. Studies showing a statistical relationship between abortion and breast cancer, increased breast cancer risk. But beyond that, we also have biological evidence that supports this statistical relationship between abortion and breast cancer. And we have animal research that supports it as well. But nevertheless, the area that they're really manipulating the data on is the statistical research, the epidemiological research. And as you know, somebody once said there are lies and then there are damn lies and there are statistics. And that's what's happening with the epidemiological research. The article that you referred to is an article that was published in the British journal called The Lancet. And anybody can go there, take a look at The Lancet, the March 26, 2004 issue of The Lancet. There's an article there by Valerie Barrell and her colleagues from Oxford University. And in that article, they claim to have conducted a comprehensive review of the research. They said they did a collaborative review of the research, which was untrue. And what they did was they eliminated 15 published studies, peer-reviewed studies. These are studies examined by their colleagues. They eliminated these studies reporting a positive link, a relationship between abortion and breast cancer. If you average these studies out, the increased risk for all these studies averaged together would be 80% risk elevation. But
now, was this from one abortion, or was it sometimes a series of abortions?
No, this is from one abortion.
One abortion with a woman who had never had carried a child to term?
This is one abortion, and yes, right, that's correct. And in addition to that, after eliminating those 15 published peer-reviewed studies, they included in their review 28 never published, never peer-reviewed studies. And you can just guess what what these studies reported.
Well, because, you know, what's I think it's so hard for people to realize is that there really are people in the scientific field who will distort science to push a political agenda. People like Kinsey, who everything was fraudulent, and so much of the breast abortion research is fraudulent, and they actually threaten people to get them to go along with their agenda.
They threaten them in the sense that if these scientists don't go along with the party line, then they can lose their government grants. And the U.S. National Cancer Institute is doing that. They are leaning on scientists. They are leaning on cancer research centers in this way because they have such a huge budget. Last year they had a budget of $4.6 billion. For this year they were asking for $5 billion.
And the best thing we could do is cut off all of that money, and then we might get some honest scientists rather than, of course, the best scientific papers that our tax money can buy. And scientists will simply go against the truth. They'll juggle the figures so that they get the money. That's what it's really all about. The great tragedy is today, you know, they come up with all these scientific reports. They come up with on Lipitor. Now, well, we just got to get the cholesterol level down. But most of the scientists who actually sign the report are on retainers from the people who make the Lipitor. What does that tell you about that? And the
right.
Same thing would get onto what we're talking about here with the abortion breast cancer of research. Yes, science is supposed to be a search for the truth. It's really become a search for funding.
Well, industry corrupts the research, and we found that out with tobacco. We found out that the tobacco industry used their money to buy the cachets of different medical research facilities, the very top, the most respected medical research facilities in this country. And the person who really blew the whistle on that was Dr. David Kessler. He's the former head of the Food and Drug Administration. He wrote a book about this corruption. And the book was just published only a few years ago. And it's called A Question of Intent. And he blew the whistle. He named names. He said Harvard University was included among those universities that accepted money. Sloan Kettering, UCLA, and he said there were others that did this. The AMA accepted $10 million from the tobacco industry the same month that the U.S. Congress was debating whether or not to provide warnings on the cigarette packages about the dangers of smoking. So we know tobacco, we know that industry corrupts scientific research and
the American Medical Association and the other medical associations. That's the trouble. And many of the doctors are corrupted by it. And, you know, and not the average doctor, but the scientists who have to have that money so they can do their scientific studies, so they can get ahead in the academic field, and they really prostitute themselves. That's what's so tragic. But when you have a country that's lost its moral foundation, should be surprised when its citizens are willing to prostitute themselves for personal gain? Go ahead, Karen.
That's what happens. You're absolutely right. And we're not the only ones who are making these allegations of corruption in the cancer establishment. There are other people that are doing that. There's a University of Chicago professor who has been making this claim for a long time now.
What's his name?
His name is Sam Epstein, and he wrote the book, The Politics of Cancer. In addition, he has a colleague who is also with him making these allegations of corruption at the National Cancer Institute. And his name is Quentin Young. He's the past president of the American Public Health Association. So we're not talking about people who are really uneducated in this field, who are shooting from the hip. We're talking about people who are medical experts at the top of their fields, who are saying the same thing that we're saying. There is corruption here in the cancer establishment, and we only need to look at the fact that this research dates back to 1957. No one told women. No one told women when U.S. government scientists wrote a letter to the British journal Lancet in 1986, February of 86, and they said induced abortion before first full-term pregnancy increases breast cancer risk. Unequivocally, there were no ifs, ands, or buts about that statement. And these same scientists, 11 years later, well, one of those scientists, flip-flopped on that statement, and she did a review when she was working for the American Cancer Society. Her own research showed an increased risk of breast cancer for women who have abortions, but yet she refused to say so in her conclusion.
And yet she, of course, had this. Was that from somebody from USC had written an article there back in that large study out of USC?
You're talking about the Mayhew-Giangreco study, 2003?
No, this was done probably about 10 years ago or more. It was really one of the first studies. It came out of USC, as I remember.
Yes.
And yet scientists there did a flip-flop as well.
Malcolm Pike
right.
did a study in 1981, the first American study, and he found a 140% risk elevation in that year. And women were not told about it. The reaction that we got, again, from Oxford scientists was to put up a study by Martin Zesi and his colleagues. And this particular study, they told women, our study was much, much larger than Malcolm Pike's study. Don't worry about Malcolm Pike's study because our findings are entirely reassuring. Those were their words. And they said an abortion will protect you from increased risk of breast cancer. But if you look at the small print in this study, how many women had abortions? There were only a handful. according to the researchers, and that makes the study entirely irrelevant.
I think of it as so hard for the average listener to realize, Karen, is there really are wicked people, and many of them are working within science today. Because they have an agenda, and some of it is not even an agenda of personal financial gain, but they really are unconcerned about people dying of cancer. In fact, we have a wonderful four-tape set called The New Order, The Barbarians, where they quote Dr. Richard Day, former medical director of Planned Parenthood, saying, there are too many people in the world, they're going to have to die of something, they might as well die of cancer. And how could anybody be that crass and indifferent and cruel? Well, they don't think it's crass and indifferent and cruel because they have no human compassion. They have a different worldview, and until we understand that, none of this really makes sense. Once you understand that, then it all begins to make sense. And why we prolong wars and create wars and don't fight epidemics that where we know what to do and allow people to die unnecessarily. But then if you believe there are too many people in the world, why, this is a good thing. As Jacques Cousteau and Bertrand Russell and so many of our leaders have actually come forward and said it. But, of course, the average American is never told about these dangers, and especially they're not teaching this in our schools, are they, Karen?
Well, correct. And every government has its propaganda. We like to believe, because we live in this country, that we don't deal with that. We think we associate propaganda with governments like the Chinese Communist government or with the Nazis. But this is a form of propaganda that women have been fed, this idea that abortion is supposedly somehow good for a woman's health, when in fact there's so much research that has been amassed against it. And we see women walking in the streets now at these cancer walks. We see thousands of women, there are hundreds of thousands of women in the industrialized world who are walking in these cancer walks for the same cancer organizations that have concealed this evidence. They've concealed the existence of this research for decades now from women.
You're talking about the American Cancer Society, which is largely funded through the great tax-exempt foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation, that is all in favor of population control, and so they're putting out, really they're lying. Hasn't the American Cancer Society done everything they could, along with the NIH, to cover up the truth about the Abortion Breast Cancer Association?
Well, and money also is, they rely heavily on the National Cancer Institute because it is a very large funder of cancer research. And so they're relying really on help from the government as well. So this has a big influence.
You're talking about the American Cancer Society.
Yes.
And we started a war on cancer, that we're going to do away with cancer, and we got more cancer. Does that make
That's
you maybe
right.
wonder that maybe we're not fighting the war to win? We're going to be back here in just a few minutes. We'll invite your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. What a tragic thing it is to see a young person dying of cancer unnecessarily. And the treatments many times are actively suppressed. But we're talking about the cause. Prevention is far better than treatment. And we're not telling the people the truth about the cause, the abortion breast cancer link. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Karen Malik, and we're talking about the abortion breast cancer link. And, of course, Karen's on the front lines of this battle, trying to get the information out, information that the average woman just doesn't know about. So this recent study that came out of England that you say was really a sort of this forged science in the name of science, putting in all sorts of un-peer-reviewed articles and throwing out the peer-reviewed articles. Are you suggesting that maybe some of these articles were not accurate? They were written with a preconceived notion rather than based upon science?
Oh, well, actually, we have found evidence that we know of at least one study, and we expect that there are more among these 28 studies, unpublished studies, that were included in the Lancet article. These are studies that were just filed away in the file cabinet. And there are we found one study that was done in Australia, and I understand there are a couple more out of Australia now, that found a positive relationship. In other words, they found that abortion increases breast cancer risk, and instead of publishing this information and informing women about the truth, informing women about the existence of this research, they filed it away in a file cabinet and never to see the light of day. And there was a study done by Rohan and his associates in 1988 that they published the data for all the risk factors that they examined except for their most significant risk factor. And that risk factor was, of course, abortion. And abortion was their most significant risk factor, and it was a statistically significant risk factor. This is not done. This is so irregular and so unorthodox, and it just never happens in the scientific world that they file away a finding like that for your most significant risk factor. But yet it does happen. I think it's important for people to recognize that the cancer establishment already recognizes certain reproductive risk factors for breast cancer. And those reproductive risk factors are childlessness. Well, if you abort all of your pregnancies, you will be childless. And they also recognize that increased breastfeeding will reduce a woman's risk for breast cancer. But the woman who aborts all of her pregnancies will never have an opportunity to breastfeed. They also recognize that women who have smaller families and women who delay their first full-term pregnancy, in other words, the later they have their first full-term pregnancy, the greater their risk for breast cancer. They recognize that women who do this have a very high risk for breast cancer, because the very best way to bring down your risk is to have that early first full-term pregnancy. But yet, the woman who has an abortion, the woman who aborts that first pregnancy, but then later goes on to have other children, she has delayed her first full-term pregnancy. And it cannot be denied that now she will
hold
have
that thought,
a smaller family.
Hold that thought for just a minute here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Karen Ralick, who works tirelessly to try to educate women about the abortion breast cancer link. And she's saying that, of course, if you abort your first child, you do not carry the child at term, you abort it during the first trimester, well, your incidence of cancer is going to increase. Is that correct, Karen?
Yes, and as a matter of fact, this is a recognized breast cancer risk. The cancer establishment recognizes if you delay that first full-term pregnancy, you will increase your breast cancer risk. Well, abortion is one of the means that women use to delay their first full-term pregnancy.
But, of course, they're doing everything they can to play it down because they want women to have abortions.
They won't even recognize that abortion has anything to do with that acknowledged breast cancer risk. They won't recognize that it has anything to do with the reproductive risk factors for breast cancer. And you and I know that's intellectually dishonest.
But we're not dealing with intellectual integrity. We're dealing with people who have a different worldview, who really don't care about human suffering, who really don't care about women
No.
get breast cancer. They want, of course, to get the world population down. They want to encourage abortion. And, of course, they're quite willing to lie and deceive and to allow these women to die horrible and painful deaths as long as it pursues their world vision. The people will openly tell you, if you talk to them privately, we look at the world differently than you do. We have a different worldview. And until we understand that really are people who look at the world differently, we can't understand why they're doing what they're doing, because it doesn't make sense to us, but it makes sense to them.
That's That's a good way of putting it. I think I would like to talk also about this other British study that was just released this month, the month of July, and it was also mentioned in the British Journal of Cancer this month. And this is particularly noteworthy because this is a study that examines, the researcher looked at the national statistics. He used national statistics for his data. He didn't look at women's interviews. He didn't rely on interviews from women. He didn't rely on individual medical records of patients. Instead, he looked at the trends of breast cancer trends in Great Britain. And he found that the best predictor of English breast cancer trends is induced abortion. And even better than that, he found that abortions before first full-term pregnancy are the strongest predictor of British breast cancer trends. And that really agrees with what we know about the biology, because when a young woman has an abortion, and she's a teenager, or she's a very young woman in her early 20s, and her breasts are still maturing, and I'm talking about on a molecular basis. I'm not talking about what you and I might see. Her breasts are still maturing at this time. To have an abortion at that time is very, very risky for that particular woman.
That is really because the hormones have actually stimulated the growth, the proliferation of the cells, and then as these cells are growing and proliferating, unbridled, and they expect they're going to go ahead and maturate, suddenly the hormones are discontinued, and here are these cells while they're growing, and suddenly the impetus that ordinarily would take them on to the point where they would become immune to cancer is removed. And these are the ones, cells, then, that will, at a later time in life, go ahead and progress into cancer. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, that would be a fair statement. And, in fact, you can go to the Journal of the National Cancer Institute monograph and look at research done by Irma and Jose Russo. And this team of researchers have looked at the importance of breast tissue maturity and its relationship to the development of breast cancer. Every young girl has cancer vulnerable tissue when she's born.
Go ahead.
And this tissue does not mature into cancer resistant tissue until a third trimester in pregnancy, until she has that full term pregnancy. That's when she's going to get the lowest breast cancer risk.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two with our special guest, Karen Malik. We invite your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Women are dying horrible and painful deaths unnecessarily because the medical establishment is lying to them. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Karen Malik. Karen, pick up the story where I so rudely interrupted you.
Oh, that's quite all right. Anybody can go to the Journal of the National Cancer Institute monograph in 2000 and look at this research by Russo and Russo. They also did earlier research in 1992 and, well, going back to 1981. But their research has to do with breast tissue maturity. Young girls have cancer-vulnerable breast tissue called type 1 breast tissue. That's what they have very, very, very early when they're born. And the tissue, their breast lobules, look like a branch from a lilac bush in wintertime. So they look very primitive and very, very immature. But at puberty, these breast lobules then mature into type 2 lobules. These are still cancer vulnerable, but the breast tissue is slightly more complex. The only thing that gives a woman cancer-resistant tissue, the only process that will give her cancer-resistant tissue, is a process that takes place in the third trimester of pregnancy. And that process is called differentiation. This is the process that matures the woman's breast tissue and provides her with milk-producing cancer-resistant tissue in the third trimester. And this is what the woman, this is what women need to do. Childbearing provides women with an increased protection from breast cancer. And this is the best way to reduce your risk for breast cancer. And as I said, you can look at the Journal of National Cancer Institute monograph. They show a clear difference. They have breast cancer slides that show clear differences between women who've had full-term pregnancies and women who've never had a full-term pregnancy. Clear differences in their breast tissue and the maturity of their breast tissue. In fact, I know a doctor who told me that she became convinced of the link between abortion and breast cancer when she saw these slides. They were that convincing.
All right. Well, now, what's the difference in incidence of breast cancer? Is there any between women who've never had a child and those who had, a first trimester abortion and those, of course, who've had multiple children? Does the increase of cancer in women who have never been pregnant, is that significantly higher, too?
Women who've never had children,
hold that thought right just a moment here. The stations are coming back on board. Our guest this evening is Karen Malik. We're talking about the breast cancer, abortion, breast cancer connection, and we're really talking about first trimester abortions. And you have your first one when you're young, and of course then you have several more. You'll double or triple your chances of getting breast carcinoma if you never carry a child to term, because it's carrying the child to term that helps. But the question was asked, what about women who never have a child? Is their incidence of breast cancer much higher?
Well, yes, I've seen statistics on that suggesting that their increased risk might be 90%. However, I'd like to stay away from that.
All right,
although there is the researcher who published the Lancet article that we discussed, where there was so much misconduct, produced some conflicting research that was widely reported in 2002, and she said that the breast cancer rates could be reduced by more than half if women would have more children and breastfeed their children longer than what they do. And she said that for each child that a woman has, the reduction in risk is 7%. For each additional child that she has.
Well, I will tell you that I have statistics that show that 1 in 3 lesbians get breast carcinoma. But they're suppressing that information because they wouldn't want to do anything to discourage young girls from taking this, I think is a tragic lifestyle. I've talked to lesbians, they're not happy. 1 in 3 lesbians gets breast carcinoma. If anybody wants the articles, we'll be glad to get them. But we're not going to let that information out, no siree, because, of course, they're going to die a lot younger with breast carcinoma. But even more than that, of course, what our young heterosexual women are doing, of course, every time they have another abortion, why, it's one more nail in their coffin, and their increased, dramatic increase in their a chance to get breast carcinoma. So they will even the people who are coming out with this fallacious material will admit that the more children you have and the more breastfeeding you do, why, the better your chances are as far as breast cancer.
The more children you have, the lower the breast cancer risk. And the more breastfeeding you do, the lower the risk. The earlier you start having your children, the earlier the age, the lower the breast cancer risk. The reason for this is, as I mentioned, girls have cancer-vulnerable breast tissue, and every month they have a menstrual cycle, and every month that menstrual cycle means that they are overexposed to estrogen, and that estrogen is a carcinogen. That estrogen is stimulating that cancer-vulnerable tissue month after month after month. So the longer the situation proceeds, the greater the breast cancer risk.
And really, this is an amazing, amazing thing. You would think that we'd be telling all of our young women how important it is for their health, you know, to get married and have children and breastfeed those children. But that isn't the message of the feminists today,
is it?
That's
not their interest. That is not their interest at all. In fact, it's not good for the cancer establishment. It's not good for business to prevent cancer. There's no money in preventing cancer. There is money in cancer research, but there is no money in preventing cancer. And so this is why women are not being encouraged to have more children in order to bring down the breast cancer risk. And I want to add that it was really about 200 to 300 years ago that it was first observed that there was a relationship between childbearing and breast cancer risk. And they observed that, scientists observed that, when they noticed that there was an increased incidence of breast cancer among nuns, because nuns do not have children. And so that is really when they first discovered, that is how they found out that estrogen had a relationship to increased risk of breast cancer. So it's all about childbearing. Breast cancer, reducing breast cancer risk is all about childbearing.
And of course, now what has happened to the incidence of breast carcinoma as we've moved away from the traditional concepts of marry early, have your children, and of course breastfeed them, and now as the women are increasingly are not having children until later age, and they will have several abortions before they have that one child they decide to keep, hasn't the incidence of breast carcinoma dramatically increased during these years?
Well, it has. And I also want to say genetics accounts for about 10% of the breast cancers. So that leaves us with about 90% otherwise unaccounted for. And as I said earlier, researchers are telling us we can cut these breast cancer rates by more than half if women have more children and breastfeed longer, start having their children at an earlier age. I think I've forgotten your original question, though.
Well,
I was going to
read
back to it.
The original question was, what was the cancer, breast cancer incident?
Oh,
yeah.
Say
100 years ago, do we have, 50 years ago, how does it compare with where we are today? With my understanding, about one in every eight women will get a breast carcinoma. Is that high, lower?
Actually, it's higher than that now. It's about 1 in 7.5.
Okay.
And just before Roe v. Wade, just before abortion was legalized in this country in 1973, the incidence was 1 in 12. So we have 1 in 12 women who could expect to be diagnosed with breast cancer.
What about 50 years ago? Do we have any idea what the incidence was then?
Well, it was higher. I mean, the incidence was much lower, even if you go back to the 1960s, but then we started using the pill also, and the pill had something to do with increasing breast cancer risk because steroidal estrogens are in the birth control pill. Steroidal estrogens are in oral contraceptives, just as they are in hormonal replacement therapy. And steroidal estrogens are on our nation's list of known carcinogens. They were just added to the nation's list of known carcinogens back in 2002.
Isn't it amazing that from the time I was in medical school, and this was back in 2019, I think I entered medical school in 48, and 72, I took my residency prior to 1960, and it was then we were just saying, oh, we've just got to give women these estrogens, you know, we'll give it for, so they won't have, premature birth, they won't have miscarriages, and course, for many of those women, their children got vaginal carcinoma, then they would pass it on to their children. And so then, of course, we find that the estrogen actually increased the growth of cancer. For years, we told women, scientifically, this is the thing you ought to be doing, and now suddenly we're getting telling them, oh, we're terribly sorry. You know, nothing we said before was true, and instead of giving women estrogens, now we're taking them off estrogens. Isn't that true?
Well, it is true, and it's strange to me that they're doing that with hormone replacement therapy, but less so with the oral contraceptives, because the steroidal estrogens are in both hormonal replacement therapy as well as the oral contraceptives. So I find that unusual, although I understand that the American Cancer Society and the Susan G. Komen Foundation are now saying that oral contraceptives will slightly increase women's risk. And you have to understand what a scientist means when he says slightly. When a scientist says slightly, slightly might mean 20-30%. And he would be accurate if he used that term slightly to when talking about a small risk like that. But for a woman who reads a website that gives that information, it's misleading, because she thinks, oh, that's no big deal then if there's only a slight increase in risk. But we have to consider what the background risk is. For the average American woman, there's a very high background risk of 13.4% lifetime risk. So if you increase an already high lifetime risk by just a very small amount, if you take a very small, if you increase a very large figure by even a small percentage, you're going to get a very large number of women who are going to develop breast cancer who would not otherwise have had breast cancer. So that's the situation that we're faced with. And
right. Well, let's go to Milt, who's calling us from Flint. This is Matt, who's calling us from Flint, Michigan. Hi, Matt. How are you doing?
Great, Dr. Stan. Glad you're back. Say, my sister had breast cancer in 87, and I began doing extensive research since she wasn't interested in doing that, merely accepting the status quo establishment party line. And I discovered, she mentioned Dr. Samuel Epstein. He authored a book, The Breast Cancer Prevention Program, wherein he lays out some significant data proving that in most of these breast tumors, the pathology data indicates the presence of significant levels of various types of carcinogenic compounds, such as the Agent Orange chemicals that are sprayed agriculturally and on people's lawns, the growth hormone antibiotic residues that are found in the commercial meat and dairy industry. Also, the presence of 60 hertz EMFs, and in my sister's case, she used an electric blanket 9 months out of the year and was a heavy dairy product user and a sweet tooth person. So I think there could well be compounding factors here, because also, I discovered a Dr. Otto Warburg, who won the Nobel Prize for discovery of the metabolic mitochondrial use of oxygen to produce ATP. And he discovered that whatever type of cancer it is, the fundamental biochemical mechanism by which all cancer originates is, in fact, the ultimate progressive predominance of anaerobic fermentative energy production that supplants the aerobic glycolysis.
No, wait, well, this is why I'm sure some people use oxygen for at least as a supplement to what's going on. Do you have any comment at all on what the Matt is saying there at all, Karen? Have you read any of these materials?
You know, I can't say that I've gone into great depth into these other areas of these other causes of cancer. I bring up the name of Sam Epstein because I know that he has been a very heavy critic of the National Cancer Institute and also the American Cancer Society. And in fact, back in August 31st of last year, he and his colleague Sam, or rather Quentin Young, wrote an article for the Los Angeles Times, and they accused National Cancer Institute and the American Cancer Society of covering up evidence linking environmental causes of cancer, linking environmental risk factors for cancer and also occupational risk hazards.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of cover-up out there, Matt, and I think that these are probably real factors, but this is separate from what we're talking about today. In other words, this is simply another one of those things that is laying our women open to so much breast carcinoma. But anything else you wanted to say?
Yeah, Dr. Stan, I just wanted to briefly state that there are initiators and promoters, and it may well be true, and obviously must be, that the lack of childbearing does have a significant impact. But I just question whether the data controlled, whether these studies actually controlled for other of these risk factors that other rather eminently credentialed researchers have uncovered.
Well, I think that there are multiple factors, but this is one that there is adequate, very adequate scientific information on, and I'm sure that there are certain women who have a genetic predisposition, and I'm sure that a lot of the toxins that are there and a lot of the hormones that are in the food we eat play an influence on it, but that is an entirely different issue. So, hey, but thanks so very much for calling.
Thank you, Doctor.
Bye-bye. And I think we got real problems out here. Cancer is on the rise. We have a war on cancer, ladies and gentlemen. The government tells us it's fighting the war, but we're fighting the war against cancer very much the way we fought the war in Vietnam, and we're losing that war. And we have to ask ourselves, why? Why did we lose in Vietnam? Why are we losing against the war and cancer here in the United States? Well, Karen, you know, as you go, first of all, let's get your website out. I'll let people know how to get in touch with your organization.
Okay, our website is www.abortionbreastcancer.com, abortionbreastcancer.com, and our toll-free number is 1-877-803-0102. That's 877-803-0102.
All right, fine. And what will people find if they go to your website?
Well, we have information for women who've had abortions or other women, any woman that wants information for herself on how to reduce breast cancer risk. There are things that women can do if they've had abortions or if they're otherwise at risk. There are things they can do to bring down their risk. There are ways to prevent breast cancer. Go to our What If I've Had an Abortion page on our website at abortionbreastcancer.com. Go to that page and you can click on that particular page and get some information from a physician about how to bring down breast cancer risk. And I'd also recommend one other website that has really excellent information about strategies women can use to bring down their breast cancer risk. And that would be Dr. Brin's website. Dr. Brind is president of the Breast Cancer Prevention Institute. Go to www.bcpinstitute.org, bcpinstitute.org, and click on the online booklet there for that information.
Oh, and of course, I know Dr. Joel Brenda. We've met him, interviewed him on several occasions, and he certainly is a crusader trying to get this information out. He's a statistician of all things. He has done, I think, the fundamental work on analyzing all of the peer-reviewed studies, and the vast majority of them show this definite abortion, breast carcinoma, linkage. But, of course, there are those that will do everything they can to conceal the truth, and the fact that many of them work for the National Cancer Institute, many of them work for the American Cancer Society, you wonder what they can possibly be thinking. So, of course, do you think we're getting the word out? Because the big propaganda machine is always putting out these articles, oh, there's no relationship at all, the NIH, the scientists, they never tell you when there's an article on the other side. It almost seems like the only articles they ever mention are those that the establishment, there's no linkage there. Go ahead, have your abortion. You got nothing to worry about. It's not going to hurt you at all. It's simple. It's painless. It solves all of your problems, but an awful lot of these people are going to die because of it.
Yes, unfortunately, that is the case. Many women are losing their lives right now, and it never used to be that young women developed breast cancer. That was exceptionally rare. Today, it's not so rare, and probably just about everyone knows somebody in their neighborhood or somebody among their friends or relatives who's had breast cancer in their 20s or 30s.
And I think what a tragic human situation it is, what a great human tragedy. When women are getting breast carcinoma unnecessarily, and then, of course, this series of surgeries, and then if that fails, well, then there's the radical surgery, and then there's the chemotherapy and the radiation, and their whole lives are affected by this. And simply if they'd been told the truth, they might have made an entirely different decision. But, of course, everything is being done. You know, you have to go to the doctor. He has to give you informed consent for every procedure imaginable and tell you about all the possible complications. He might die or get an infection or fail. He has to give you informed consent for every procedure but an abortion. They could influence you for the rest of your life and kill you. Why do you think that is, that doctors aren't required under law to give informed consent to the girls?
Well, that's a very good question. There was an effort made in Minnesota to tell women about this. In fact, there was a law passed requiring doctors to tell women that an abortion will increase the risk for breast cancer. In fact, there was a requirement of the Minnesota Health Department to give this information online to women. But who threw their weight behind this and tried to stop it? It was Minnesota Medical Association, which struggled for months to try to get the state's health department to take that information off of its website. And unfortunately, its governor, who calls himself pro-life, by the way, caved in to the pressure that he was subjected to from the Minnesota Medical Association and also from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists.
Well, I think, though, Karen, you have to understand that the people who get into leadership positions in organized medicine do usually because they have an agenda. And I've been there. I've been part of these organizations. And I will tell you that, you know, you have to be totally dedicated to give so much time and go to so many meetings. To get into a position of leadership, you have to have an agenda. And the great tragedies they do. Well, we've got time for one more quick call for Will from Missouri. Will, do you have a quick question and comment?
Well, I do have just a quick comment, and I would like to address it to both of you. An excellent broadcast, by the way. The political implications of this are pretty profound. I've always been a pro-choice person politically because I do believe that issues of conscience are so hard to legislate, and that when people find themselves without choice, they'll take perhaps a more dangerous alternative. But in this particular thing, I see that the opportunity here to really increase the political discourse so that young people are really aware that although abortion may be high on the things that they would like to do or that they think they could do, or perhaps if their parents are putting pressure in this direction, this gives an entirely new meaning, and it certainly has opened my eyes tonight because I never knew that anything like this was connected to it.
No, they've been lying to us for a long time, Will, and you're absolutely right. That young people should have the right to know, the parents should have the right to know, but they don't, and they certainly don't tell women that this decision that they're making now can be with them the rest of their life, and the life that they're taking may also lead to the loss of their own life down the line. Hey, we're out of time. God bless. Thanks so much for calling, and please keep listening.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Karen, we're out of time, but I really want to thank you so much. I want to get you on all of our other programs. This was, of all the programs we have ever done, this is the best one.
Oh, well, thank you so much, and I'm so grateful.
God, good night and God bless
you. Well, good night.
Okay, finally, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly I want to remind our listeners out there that if you're listening on shortwave, why they're going to change our frequency again next Monday at 7.315, that's 7.315, unless you hear to me contrary. Next week when you turn in at this number, there'll be somebody else here, and they're going to put us on 7.315. So please be prepared for that a week from today, unless you hear otherwise. Of course, hopefully you'll be listening every evening this week, and if anything comes up, I'll certainly let you know. And then, of course, we do hope that you'll tell other people about our programs. You can hear us on the internet at www.radioliberty.com, and we're streaming right now at www.radioliberty.com. You can hear us 4 hours a day on shortwave right now on 7.535, but soon in this hour at 7.315. And then, of course, you can hear our earlier program, which is actually 3 to 5 on the West Coast and 6 to 8 on the East Coast at 9.430. That's 9.430. Please tell others, encourage them to listen, become informed, understand that there really are evil and wicked people out there. We hope many of you will want to get our population control agenda monograph. You can get it up on the internet, or if you get the 4-tape set on population control that explains why they outlawed DDT. It was simply we'd kill more people. Why they're pushing abortion and euthanasia. Why, of course, we have wars and epidemics and AIDS. And it's all part of a population control agenda. As difficult as it is to realize and to face, there really is evil in the world. We have a wonderful video. We have a 4-tape set on population control. We have tape sets on water fluoridation, on mercury, on aspartame. Why do we still have cancer? Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and then pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for...